I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Intercooler podcast is sponsored by JBR Capital, one of the UK's leading car finance specialists. Now, we only partner with like-minded organisations who really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast, and JBR Capital is a perfect fit for us. It's run by people who really love cars, and importantly, vehicle finance is all JBR Capital does. That alone is what the company exists to do. So whether you're looking to fund a classic, sports car, supercar or hypercar, see what JBR Capital can do for you. And it's not just about very high-end, expensive unobtainium. In fact, the minimum borrowing is £25,000 and the average, £80,000. Head to JBR Capital on social media or jbrcapital.com online and tell them the Intercooler sent you. Right, let's get on with this week's podcast. Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 96 of the Intercooler podcast. I'm Dan Prosser, not with Andrew Frankel this week. Yeah, this week's episode is going to be a little bit different. On the app, on the Intercooler app for subscribers only, we run what we call TI Super Podcasts. They're for app subscribers only and they're guest-based. So we always have a guest on. And this time, to give the general TI audience a flavour of what it is that we do with these TI Super Podcasts, we decided to make this one available on general release, as it were, so anyone can listen to it. It's an interview with TI writer and former F1 driver, former Le Mans driver, Karun Chandhok, who's a brilliant guy, insightful, just good company, good to talk to about racing. We talk about his early career, about his start in India. We talk about when he first came to the UK, and he explains what it's like for an Indian driver to test through a British winter for the first time. He also talks about his time in F1 and some of the stuff that he's up to now, including his Sky F1 punditry. I think it's a good listen. So he also talks actually about how good he sort of assesses himself as a racing driver. He talks about how good he actually was, and he just speaks very frankly, very honestly, very openly. I think it's interesting to hear a racing driver talk in that way. So have a listen. I hope you enjoy it. And if you want to hear more TI Super Podcasts, download the Intercooler app and subscribe. Thank you. Welcome, everybody, to this TI Super Podcast. And my guest today is Karun Chandhok, former F1 driver, former Le Mans racer, now a Sky F1 pundit, and most importantly of all, a TI writer. An insightful guy. Karun, I always learn something about motorsport when I hear you speak or when I read your words. More than anything, though, you're one of those guys, and I think the Franchitti's are the same. They're just huge motorsport buffs. They're massive motorsport fans who got to live that dream by being a professional racing driver. Do you see it that way?
In some ways, yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it goes back to the root of why we became racing drivers, and that's because we were passionate fans of the sport in the first place. You know, certainly for me, I think, like Dario and Marino, who you mentioned, you know, we're fans at heart of the sport. We obviously loved the experience of driving the cars and wanting to be racing drivers and becoming racing drivers. But even now, you know, we're the fans who are sitting there who would watch and follow most forms of motorsport and like going to places like Goodwood and spend hours drooling over all the different cars and sights and sounds and chatting with people that, you know, you get to meet in this wonderful business. So, yeah, you know, I think the passion comes certainly from being a fan of the sport first.
Yeah, and that's what makes you good at what you do. You're a fan of the sport, you're a student of the history of the sport, and so you understand it, and that's why it's interesting to hear what you have to say. So we spoke a couple of weeks ago, and I was surprised when you told me that you've never raced a kart. And compared to other people who pursue careers in F1, that probably means you've missed out on 8 to 10 years of learning.
Yeah, absolutely.
A big hindrance?
I think so. You know, when you think about the concept of muscle memory and building that repetition into the nervous system of your body, where everything just becomes second nature, it's completely, you know, factual that what the kids learn in karting is going to benefit them through their entire career. And you look at the entire, you know, world of Formula One today, these are all young drivers who have done between 6 and 8 years of karting. But you look outside of our sport, right? You know, I was watching an interview with Rafa Nadal after he's won the Australian Open. And you know, he was talking about how from the age of 3, he was out with Uncle Tony on the tennis court hitting balls and just building that muscle memory of the, you know, of the ground strokes. And it just, so, you know, I think, look, I had to play with the cards I was dealt with, right? You know, I grew up, I was born and raised in India. We had no kart tracks at the time. We had no karting championships at the time. That's changed, you know, all of that exists now, but it didn't exist when I started. And so, you know, I can't change the past. You just have to get on with it. But unquestionably, there's a disadvantage to that.
So I think you started at about 16, didn't you, in a little single-seater thing that's, I think, specific to India. Can you tell us about that car and about that championship?
Yeah, it's called the Formula Maruti. I wrote a column about it. I think there's a picture on the TI app and website soon. So I think it's probably comparable to Formula First that you had in the UK and other parts of Europe, something similar. I think Germany had Formula König, where people like Schumacher started. Yeah, a little 800cc engine out of a road car with a 4-speed H-pattern gearbox, again, straight from the road car in a little tubular frame. So very, you know, small, light cars, only 300, I think they were 320 kilos, if memory serves me right.
Wow.
So, really, really tiny. But it's only an 800cc engine. I mean, I remember when we put the engines on the dyno, a good engine would be all of 44 horsepower or 45 horsepower. I am talking
a monster.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but if you think about it, at that level, if you had an engine that had 46 instead of 45, you were suddenly flying. And you know, it was great fun. You know, good, and actually the competition was good. There were a whole bunch of us young drivers who started at the same time, and I'm still friends with some of them. You know, we all. We were of similar age between sort of 16 and 19 and all racing together and battling each other and crashing into each other and going testing for hours together. It was great fun. But it's funny, I look back and I've been involved in the sport now for, you know, basically my whole life. But I raced in 2000 in India, and that was the last time I raced in India. It's been 22 years since I last raced there, which is quite odd, really.
Yeah. So, okay, I want you to put all ego and modesty to one side, right? And just tell me, when did you know that you were good? At 16, did you get in it? And was it immediately obvious to you that, I can do this?
I think it was probably when I competed in my first season of racing in that Indian Championship, because I actually did two. I raced a saloon car championship with Suzuki Swift alongside the single-seater one. And I think it was probably that, because in this, long story short, but we had various issues with the car and the single-seater ones. The chassis cracked, and so I missed half the season on that. But in the saloon car championship, I was racing against people who had been doing it for years. There were people who were basically racing against my dad. And at my first race, I got pole position, fastest lap, and won the race. And I ended up winning, you know, I think I won 7 out of the 10 races that year in that championship against people who'd been doing it for 15, 20 years. So from an Indian context, you know, I thought, okay, I'm obviously reasonable and able to drive a car. But I think until and unless you actually compete and win at something, you don't really know.
Yeah. And so I think, I'm not sure why this is, and perhaps it's just something I've picked up on, but I think there's a perception that you might have come from bottomless pits of family money to get you through racing, or that you had enormous sponsors from home in India backing you all the way through. We don't need to do it in detail, but I suspect that's not quite the case. And actually, there were points, weren't there, where you really thought this racing dream was grinding to a halt.
Oh, it was probably every winter. I was very lucky. My family were willing to take out a second mortgage on the house and sell everything they had to you know, give me the chance to come to Europe and go racing. But you know, it took us, I think we, you know, the debt that got built up in the first 6 years took us another 10 to recover from. And that's the reality of it. So it took a huge effort from everyone around me, to go out there, and we raised the money. And but I never had the full budget. If you know, I look at when I was doing Formula 3, you know, we had less than 300,000, and people like Nelson Piquet, Will Power, there were other drivers in there who, you know, they were well into the 500s at that stage. So there's significant difference, you know, when you're talking that sort of budget. When you look at, I went to GP2, we had I think I had probably €300,000 to do GP2, and a full budget at the time was 1.8 million. I got lucky that Red Bull came along at the right moment, because at that stage I was about to stop and take up a job as a team manager for a team. So it was all done and dusted, and then Red Bull came along at the right moment, put a bit of money in. But we still only had, in total, I think that first year at Durango, we had €700,000 as opposed to 1.7, 1.8 that other teams and other drivers were spending. So, that has a huge knock-on effect, right? It means you don't change the brakes as often. You don't have engines rebuilt as often. There's so many things that lead directly to performance and lap time, let alone, you know, going testing and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I couldn't afford to have a personal trainer or a physio, which if you look at kids like Lando and sort of modern, you know, a lot of the young drivers, that's just unheard of. They wouldn't even comprehend that. The first time I had a personal trainer or a physio who came with me to the races was when I got to F1.
Wow.
And so, yeah, look, I think it's easy for people who don't know the backstory to assume that. I get it. But I think, you know, I had to work bloody hard at going out there to raise commercial sponsorship out there. And I was fortunate to have good Indian companies at key moments that supported me along the way, as well as companies like Red Bull, you know, and Tag Heuer and people like that on a global level.
Do you know what? If people want to see a really good account of your career from the horse's mouth, they should go and watch the interview on YouTube that you did with Mario Muth. I don't know if I'm getting his surname right there, but it's a lovely video, and it details your career, and it's a great account of it. So people should check that out if they want to know more. We're not going to do it here, but I think it's about 20 years ago since you came to the UK.
Well, it's in fact, Dan, it's as we record this, it's 20 years and 3 days.
Wow. So there you go. Pretty good timing. And so what caught my eye when I heard you talking about this was that you'd never really driven in the rain before, because you said in that part of Asia, if it rains, it's monsoon rain and the red flag's out. So I just tell me about the first time you found yourself in the winter in England or in the UK, maybe in Pembrey or Snetterton, freezing cold, conditions you've never seen before. What on earth goes through your mind?
I just kept spinning. We were at it was at Pembrey. I came to do a test in October 2001 with Carlin in Formula 3, and the whole concept of cold tires and you know, needing to build the temperature up slowly and you know, having low grip conditions and dew and dampness on the ground, you know, it's all just so alien to me. You know, the whole, and then it carried on into early 2002, where you'd go winter testing in Donington. You know, A, you've got the aviation fuel, B, then it's raining and 3 degrees. And I just couldn't comprehend how low grip the whole, you know, the whole experience was of driving a race car in the wet. It was a massive shock to the system. And to be honest, it destroyed my confidence for a long time. It took me probably till May that year, the first 4 months, I was, you know, deer in headlights. What am I doing here? This, you know, I'm not cut out for this. This is just going to be a disaster. You know, you plug away and you plug away and you plug away and you see little glimmers of hope and you see little bits of data and little bits of, you know, lap time here and there at a session that thinks, okay, I'm not that far off. I can make it work if I just line these cherries up. But yeah, I mean, it, you know, first coming here to race in Europe was a complete shock to the system after spending the first couple of years in Asia.
Does that make the UK a good place to learn? And also, I suppose, all the different types of track that we have here in the UK. Presumably, as a youngster, those first couple of seasons, you're just absorbing infinite amounts of knowledge and experience.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up probably 5 years in the first year that I came here to live. You know, I think I think the UK is a great place for a young driver to learn to go single-seater racing. The tracks are difficult. You know, they're narrower than the European tracks in general, apart from Silverstone. So, you know, if you can be quick and competitive at tracks like Oldham Park or Croft and, you know, even circuits like Castle Coombe, where we used to go through at Formula 3, they're really difficult because it's a short lap, knock hill, you know, they're short laps, sub 50-second lap, I think, knock hill. With a lot of corners and a narrow track and undulating, you know, layout. So if you could be confident and quick and competitive and gain a lot of confidence by driving these different weather conditions as well here in the UK, then I think you could go anywhere in the world, really, and be strong. And I think, yeah, it's a great place for drivers to learn how to drive.
So you got to F1. And you did 10 Grand Prix that year and then won the next year. How do you reflect on your time in F1? Are you just glad sitting here now to have made it? I mean, you raced in the Monaco Grand Prix with Hamilton, Alonso, Button on the grid. Or do you actually think, do you have a racer's view of it and think, I never got a chance in an F1 car to show what I could really do?
I think I had the latter view for a period of time. Immediately after F1, I think certainly I'd say between 2012 and sort of 15, 16, not in that long, probably 2012, 13, 14, I had that view where, you know, I just didn't feel like I had the opportunity to do it properly and to you know, have a proper go. But then you sort of accept that, okay, that door is closed and you've got to move on with life and get on with life. And then now, actually, I look back at it and go, if I look at the circumstances that took me on the path to F1, it's mad, really, to think that somebody from India, you know, two continents away, was able to have the life I did for that 10-year period, and the risks that we took from a financial and you know, family standpoint, and, you know, literally, you know, a few races here and then you run out of money, and then it's, you know, you're just literally going hand to mouth in terms of trying to get a budget to go racing. It you know, in that respect, then you start to think back, actually, it is quite an achievement. And also, once you've been a Formula One driver, that can't ever be taken away from you. You know, as you say, that fact that you were on the grid with Schumacher and Alonso and Hamilton and all these people can never be taken away from you. And that means something in the wider world. You know, it obviously means something in the motorsport world, but it means something in the wider world as well. And I think that's something you have to hang on to.
So tell us about your experience of F1, particularly the F1 team you were with, Hispania. I mean, it was a small team, a back-of-the-grid team, but was it a positive environment? I think you've said that actually some of the people there were fantastic.
It's a team where there was a lot of untapped potential, really, to be honest. You know, there were some great people in there. They had a very good partnership with Dallara. And actually, you know, you look at what Haas did. You know, Haas arrived in Formula One and was straight away in the midfield. And that was with Dallara. And, you know, Dallara built, they're a very good car company, and they build good race cars. But they, for various financial and political reasons, between Colin Collis and the Spanish side and Dallara, they all fell out with each other quite spectacularly. And it meant that we never got the car that we should have had. You know, basically the car that raced was the one that should have only gone to a hotel in Spain as a launch. And we were meant to get a car with another massive upgrade, which was 60 points of downforce, which is about 3 seconds of lap time. You know, that would have put us into firmly in the midfield, which funnily enough is where Haas was when they arrived with Dallara. So I think there was a lot of untapped potential of that entire project because the money wasn't there, and then the internal politics was exhausting. I mean, some of it now, when you look back, was comical. at the time, it wasn't very funny, but, you know, now when you look back, it was comical. Like, I remember coming to the pits in Barcelona before FP1. I walked into the pits, and as I walked in, Christian Kleen walked towards me, and he was carrying his race suit and helmet, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I said, well, I'm going to drive the car." And he's like, "No, I'm driving your car." And basically, he was scheduled to drive FP1 in my car. Nobody even told me about it. I looked at the car, and it was, so both of us, because I got on well with Christian, and I still do. We both looked at the car, and one side of the car had my name on it, and the other side had his name on it. So we're like, well, what's going on here? And, you know, so some of that stuff was just a little bit mad. But, you know, the experience, you know, that experience of being on the grid and all the mechanics and all the noise and the media and everybody goes away, and there are only 20 of you, well, at that time there's 26 of us, you're doing the formation lap and you go and line up on the grid and the rest of the world is gone and there are just you and 25 others on the Formula One grid. That's pretty special, you know, when you're driving around and you look at it and go. And I remember, I think that probably the third race of the year was Malaysia, and it was a wet qualifying, and McLaren and Ferrari completely got the weather forecast wrong. And all of a sudden, you know, Lewis and Fernando and the Ferrari and stuff was sitting next to us at the back of the grid. And it's pretty surreal, you know, when you think of it as in that respect. So, yeah, I think, but probably my favorite memory has got to be at the first race, because obviously that was a culmination of a dream, you know. And when I got to the paddock in Bahrain, the first driver that came to say hello was Michael. And, you know, back in 94, 95, Michael was my hero. I had, the poster on the bedroom wall, and I was a massive fan of his. And so when he, you know, 2010, he had returned after sabbatical. This was the biggest star in Formula One by a long way at that point, because Lewis was, you know, had won one championship and was just getting going. But Michael was by far the biggest global Formula One star, and I was a nobody out of GP2. But, you know, my very first day on the Thursday, the media day in Bahrain, he came and, you know, he introduced himself and just chatted, wanted to get to know a little bit about me, where I came from, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, just said, welcome to F1 and good luck for the season. And, you know, it was just, he didn't need to do that. But I always, always look back at that fondly and think, just what a nice guy.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite memories.
Just think back then to that first Grand Prix. So when I'm sitting at home and the five lights are about to go out at the start of the race, I can't cope. I can't bear it. My heart is racing. I almost want to just stand up and get out of the room and walk away. I can't cope with the tension. But you're there in your car and the five lights are about to go off. Is it unbearable for you as well, or are you just relishing every second?
No, you're focused on the job. You're there to do that. You know, don't forget, that's what you've trained for through the junior categories and junior formula racing. So you have to be respectful of the situation you're in and respectful of the other drivers, these other great names and world champions that you're surrounded by. But you can't be in awe of it. You can't be in awe of the situation, because then you don't do justice to your job. And I was very conscious of that.
And so we know you were in a back-of-the-grid car. You've since driven front-of-the-grid cars, I guess, in demos and so on. But just explain to me what a comparatively slow F1 car feels like to drive. Is it still leaps and bounds ahead of everything? Does it still tear your head off?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. You know, it's still... The slowest car on the grid is still miles quicker than any other race car on the planet. You know, the slowest F1 car will still be three, four seconds quicker than a GP2 car or an LMP1 car, really. Mm. So it's... And that's where people, I think, sometimes misunderstand the concept of, you know, whatever team it was, whether it was Minardi back then or Haas last year or whatever, you know, they're still amazingly fast race cars. They just have less downforce. The biggest difference is downforce, right? You know, I'd say probably since the mid-90s, aerodynamics became the biggest differentiator in Formula One. And ever since then, it's just, that's been the exponential... exponentially big differentiator between the top and middle and the back of the grid F1 cars is just aero and downforce. So, because once you get, if you have the downforce and the aerodynamics working properly, then everything else works better. The tires come into the operating window better. The suspension works better. Everything just works better when you have downforce. It is literally a driver's best friend. So, and that's the difference. You know, but if you have more downforce, you go around the corners faster. It's simple as that, really.
I've always suspected that for guys in those back of the grid cars, the frustration must be that you can have a storming weekend, the weekend of your career, and you still finish 18th, and no one knows. Were you ever aware of that? Did you think you put in a qualifying or a race performance in your F1 time that really was the best you could possibly do? And yet no one really noticed.
Yeah, 100%. I look back, there's a race in Valencia, for example. I remember, I was teammates with Bruno Senna that year, and I was quicker than him all weekend long. And, you know, I had a really good race. We were definitely the slowest team on the grid by some margin that year. But I finished somewhere ahead of him, but I also ended up beating, I think I beat Timo Glock in the Virgin Racing car as well. And, you know, it was just a good weekend, all weekend long. I worked really hard with the engineers, got the car dialed in into a good setup window. And it just worked really well. And, but, you know, as you say, it was anonymous. I actually finished 18th in that race.
There you go.
Completely anonymous to the outside world.
Okay, so as I said earlier, it'd be great if we could put all ego and modesty to one side and just have a truthful conversation. You won championships on your way up the ladder. You won races in GP2. You don't get to do that without being a damn fine racing driver. But just tell me, how good were you? How did you compare to those sort of child prodigies that we see from time to time? And
listen,
what were your strengths?
I think I was. I would say I was probably in the very good category, but not in the great category. If I look back at it, being truthful, I wasn't in the world champion category. I think there are very few drivers on the planet who are. And, I think the reality was I was in the right team, in the right car. I was probably in a position to have, good, strong results and maybe win some races and get podium, things like that. But I think, there's a very small category of drivers at Formula One level. I'm talking about, I think actually, when you go to sports car level, I think I was probably better suited to sports cars, because a couple of things I was very good at was, looking after the tires, fuel management, and consistency. I was always, quite smooth in the way I drove, and I always was better at fuel economy at Le Mans, for example, than my teammates, and managed the brakes and things like that. So, I would say I was probably a better, relatively better sports car driver than Formula One. But yeah, I think if being perfectly honest, I was probably in the very good rather than the great category.
That's brilliant to hear a racing driver talk so frankly and honestly. It's not very often that we get to hear that, so thank you. And also, you didn't start until you were, 16 or something. You didn't drive in the wet until you were 18 or whatever it was. It's not like you had that upbringing that a lot of these kids do these days, did you?
Yeah, but they're all, those are all excuses, really, aren't they?
Yeah, fair play, fair enough. Okay, so nowadays, I think you're probably best known for your Sky F1 punditry work. As I said at the top, I think you're Sky's most insightful pundit. I just love listening to what you have to say. But tell me about what that's like. I mean, you'll be at a track and some big flashpoint will occur. Perhaps it's Max and Lewis coming together at Silverstone. And then what happens? Does the producer say, Karun, we're coming down to you at the Skypad and we want a definitive verdict on what's gone on here? You've got all this pressure. It's an emotionally charged thing. That must be a difficult thing to deliver.
Well, it is because, you just know that there's so many people with opinions nowadays. There's so many good things about the internet, but one of the bad things is that it's given every person on the planet a platform and a sense of anonymity where they feel that they could just hurl abuse and, shout opinions at you for just because they may disagree. People seem to have lost that, and I'm generalizing, I should say, a lot of people seem to have lost the ability to just have a healthy debate and disagreement and agree to disagree at the end of it. And instead, if they disagree with you, all they do is hurl abuse at you and tell you should be sacked and you're unbelievably biased and they can't believe you're on television and blah, 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 blah. It's just tedious, so there is that pressure. But fortunately for me, I haven't ever really cared about that bit of it. I just do.
That's the solution.
I'm amused. It amuses me, I mean, I screenshot some of the funniest, and they're not funny. They're funny to me because I'm quite thick skinned and I don't take any of it seriously. But you can see why, online abuse and trolling is such a real thing, because it's, if someone is a bit more sensitive to it, you can see why they'd be quite hurt just by the way that, comments are thrown around. So, it's an interesting one, but part of the job is to take on that pressure and to, that's what we're paid to do, really, is to give opinion and stand by that opinion. But equally, and you mentioned Lewis and Max at Silverstone, that was an interesting one, because I started off going, it's probably 50-50, And then actually I changed my mind as I watched him more and more. You know, so when the incident happened, straight off the accident and the red flag and all that, I thought it was sort of 50-50. And as the afternoon unfolded, I watched it again. I was like, okay, Lewis really could have backed out of it a bit more. So I changed my opinion to 70-30. And I think that's fine. You know, I think it's fine for someone to recognize that they haven't necessarily made a judgment instantaneously. Or if they have, then they're willing to learn and educate themselves and change their opinion. I think that's fine.
It is fine. And we as a society have lost that skill, largely. We, rather than be open and take on new information and adjust our point of view, which is the grown-up thing to do, by and large, we dig our heels in, don't we? And then shout louder.
I mean, the Abu Dhabi last year has been ridiculous. You know, the fallout of that is just, it's bonkers. You know, even yesterday, there are people tweeting about it. You know, well, I'll show you. I often do this every couple of days. But, well, quickly, yesterday's tweet, my top troll yesterday said, Karun, you should get the sack for being an incompetent, biased mother F you, da, 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 da. This will come back and bite you in the ass when you least expect it. Your Sky buddies won't stick up for you. Karun has no backbone, hashtag. And it's like, this was yesterday's classic. Yeah. So anyway, there
Deary
you go.
Me.
But yeah, it's just like, and you know, that was in response to me saying that in the race in Abu Dhabi, the safety car should have only been out for a couple of laps. Unfortunately for Michael Massey, when he made that decision, he got a bit screwed over because the brakes got fired on the Williams and the extinguisher had to come out, and it was two or three more laps. It's a bit unfortunate, but that's what happened. And they, you know, people just pile into that. And what they're not willing to even listen to is the next part of the sentence where I say, when he'd made the decision to leave the safety car out, he should not have let the lap cars pass, or selected those five cars lap pass, which is, you know, giving it context. And I think that's the problem with this sort of clickbait, trigger-happy society we've got at the moment.
Oh, completely agree. It's enormously frustrating. People react. They don't take the time to try and understand someone's point of view. It's immensely frustrating. And yet, you and I, people in the media, the great privilege that we have is that we get to have a platform to express a point of view. And I'm sure you treasure that as much as I do. It's a very special thing.
But that's the point, though. I think it used to be a very special thing. And now social media has made it less special because everyone feels like they've got a platform to express themselves. You know, every person, every third person can have a blog and this and that. But the trouble is they're not as well informed, nor are they willing to do the research. You know, you often, you see these websites about, you know, around F1. There's now dozens of these websites that have popped up. And all these people are doing are sort of copy-pasting bits and pieces of stories from other people who go out there and go to the races and do the donkey work and do the research and, you know, spend their lives and their money and their time as, you know, trying to do their job properly, only for it all to be sort of half-baked, copy-pasted into a clickbait article by some website who don't invest the time or money to do it properly, frankly, and aren't even accredited by the FIA. So it's a funny world that we live in now.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of noise out there, and it's a few lone voices that are worth listening to. Yours is one, and it's what we're trying to do with TI, you know, make it stand out from all that noise and have some authority. Okay, well, let's just do a couple of minutes on the 22 F1 season. It's just around the corner. I think we saw the first car today, didn't we, the Haas? Are you fired up? Do you think we're going to see some better racing? Do you think we're going to see the likes of McLaren and Ferrari competing for race wins more often?
The truth is, we don't know. I think only an idiot would predict who's going to be quick and who's not before the first race. Because, you know, I think this is singularly the biggest regulation change we've had in Formula One history between one season and the next. Unless you sort of, you know, you're going back to the 50s or 60s where they suddenly started allowing F2 cars into F1 and all that sort of stuff. So I think You know, this is a massive, massive shift. And I think it's therefore an opportunity for people to get it right more than others. I think we're going to see a huge amount of evolution in just the way the cars change from the first race in Bahrain till even the halfway point when we get to Silverstone, frankly, before, let alone the back half of the year. So I think there's just because we get to Bahrain and XYZ are competitive, it doesn't mean that they'll be there at the end of the year. I think a lot's going to change throughout the season. I think the usual suspects will be strong, right? I mean, Mercedes showed last year they got incredible strength and depth. They, at the start of the year, they were behind. They were 3-4 tenths behind. And by the back half, back part of the season, the last four races, they had the quickest car, conclusively. So, you know, they showed just what a strong race team they are. Red Bull showed that, you know, Newey hasn't forgotten how to design race cars, and they were strong last year. I have this sort of niggling feeling that there's, I think, something special coming from Ferrari. I think they should be closer to the fight this season, which will be exciting to watch. And we'll see. You know, I think we'll just have to see. But I'm excited because it's new, and we don't. And that's what made last season great. Is we went to every race not knowing who was going to win. And on top of that, you got George versus Lewis. You know, you've got Lando is going to be better than he was last season, where he was amazing already. And you know, what's the world champion Max going to be like? You know, is it? You know, that was never a bloke who was short of confidence, but is it going to make him even more confident coming back with the number one on his car? There's got to be something special in that.
Oh, I just can't wait. It's not long now, is it? A few weeks. Testing soon, and we get to find out, maybe get a little snapshot, who is quick, who isn't. It's going to be really exciting. And I'm sure you'll be there to talk us through it all. But listen, we'll leave it there. Thank you for your time. It's brilliant to hear from you, Curran. You're, as I said at the top, you're insightful, you're knowledgeable, and it's just interesting to hear you talk about racing.
No, absolute pleasure as always. We should do it again.
We will. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.